from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The presence of news has never been stronger. It comes at us from all sides these days. Is it the news flow and perspective that we need? Is it the news we deserve? Writer Alain de Botton gives us the philosopher's view in his new book, The News, A User's Manual. He's told us how Proust can change our lives, how to think about sex and work and status. Now he's on the news. This hour on Point, we're thinking meta-level about how we handle the news. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is the news enlightening these days, empowering, enervating? How does it shape your view of the world? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from London is Alain de Botton, one sometime philosopher, author of The Architecture of Happiness, of The Consolations of Philosophy, of How Proust Can Change Your Life. His new book is The News, A User's Manual. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Alain, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much.
We've got news everywhere and you're not happy. Why?
Well, look, it's not that I'm totally unhappy. I just think it's a very weird thing that we live in a world where there is news all around us, and yet we're never systematically taught how to handle it. And what I wanted to do in my book was to provide a kind of consumer's guide, not so much looking at the industry from a professional's point of view, but looking at it from the audience's point of view. It's like with food. You know, we know that nowadays that we've got to be more conscious consumers of food. And I think we have to be more conscious consumers of news. We're one of the first generations to be flooded by news options. And, you know, we're not always doing things well. You know, people have criticized the news for keeping us rather passive and supine and confused. It's almost like you've got two options with the news nowadays. If you want to keep a population down, you either throttle the news, give people no news, or else you just flood them with so much news, they often just can't tell what was going on. And that's the position of many of us nowadays. We can't even remember what it was happening in the news last week. It's overwhelming.
It's funny you say if you were the great dictator, you would not use censorship. Instead, you would what? Flood the field.
Absolutely. You know, censorship is old hat, much cleverer nowadays, just to distract people with so much news that you can't hold on to what the important themes are. And I think that's the problem. And I don't think we're living in a sort of giant conspiracy. I think it's in a way even more sinister. If it was a conspiracy of a few, you know, white males hidden somewhere in a room trying to pull all the levers, we could kind of get in there and get them. It's more sinister. It's that we don't even understand that we are living in a world where there is so much information that in order to get political traction for any issue, it becomes so hard to get an audience to follow you. This is what one thing that politicians always complain about. They can't get the audience to concentrate for long enough to provide real change. And that's a real subversion of that original democratic dream, which is that if you inform people, you can then motivate political change in a society. And that's kind of come unstuck because of the unbelievable overflow of news.
Inform, motivate, and a democracy works with that. Overwhelm, enervate, and it might not work. Is this just impressionistic, Alain, or you know, what's your evidence that we have societies flooded, enervated by just chaos of news?
Look, I mean, there's, you know, you don't need to be a social scientist to recognize that there has been an enormous expansion in the number of news outlets, and this has all kinds of consequences. One of the things that it leads us to ask is, what do I really need the news for? Now, in the past, that question was answered. The news was something that the editor selected for you. There was this figure called the editor who made the selection, picked out the 50 or so stories that you needed to know, and you know, gave it you over your breakfast. Nowadays, each of us has the possibility of becoming our own news editors. And in a way, that's a beautiful utopian dream, the idea of personalized news, the idea that you will find your way to the information which is most essential to you. And that's terrific, except that like many situations of extreme choice, it presents an incredible burden to us to know what it is we actually need. And so in a way, personalized news is only good as the audience's level of self-knowledge, because we need to know ourselves pretty well to know just how much, you know, political, sociological, enviable news we might need. So that's just another hurdle facing us.
Look, I've been in the business for a long time, so I'll try not to be defensive here. Anyone can see that there's a lot going on. There's a lot that's changing. I do wonder, though, about readers or listeners or viewers' capacity to sort this out for themselves, if it might not be a little greater than you suggest. I mean, I'm reading you here talking about how the very structure of the news is delivered as though it's delivered to a minister of state who's going to be making consequential, impactful decisions about national policy on a world stage. And yet it's just going to the little people who have no power on that scale. You're kind of mocking that conceit of delivering everybody the news as though they have some weight and consequence in their response to it. But just starting right there, isn't that a legitimate conceit in a democracy in any case?
Well, I think it comes to the head when you think of what gets called world news, news from abroad. And there you get information that is given to people, often very shocking. You know, the other day, last week, 100 people died in fighting in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that is given to people as information. And in a way, journalists always expect that if you present listeners and viewers with that kind of stark information, people will care. And then an extraordinary thing happens, quite a depressing thing. On the whole, people don't care. And why is that? Is that, are we monsters? Are we racist? Are we incapable of concentrating on anything? No, not at all. It's that the news machine has an information-based view of what it needs to do. In other words, it believes that if you present people with facts, 100 people have died, they will care. The thing is, that's not quite true. In order to get people to care, you need to do a lot more preparatory work, which the news, in its compacted, immediate form, often doesn't have the chance, the opportunity to do. And so you get a situation of kind of globalized provincialism, where you both have a lot of information about all sorts of places, and yet a kind of apathy about that information. And that's just, you know, we didn't think it was going to be like that. In the 19th century, when pioneers went out and, you know, explored foreign countries and brought back information from faraway lands, the belief was information on its own will be enough. What we're finding now is that you need to do quite a lot of work with that information before you can get people to care about it.
I mean, we have different streams of news, though, don't we? I mean, one stream may be just freighter hijacked pirate hit off the coast of Somalia. Another stream may be an analytical piece that comes in alongside or after that piece, talking about the economic and clan pressures in Somalia that produce piracy. And yet another may be about global shipping and international commerce. And I mean, don't cumulatively, if you care to find it, isn't all this context out there right now?
Look, there is an unbelievable number of options for news, and yet the amazing thing is that there is still such a thing as a news agenda, which heavily colors the kinds of questions that most of the population ask themselves. Take the financial crisis. Of course, there were outlying bits of information out there in the ether about, you know, sending us alarm signals about the way in which the economy was being run. But isn't it amazing how that information did not get through despite the unbelievable plethora of news outlets? And that is because in the modern world, despite the multiplicity of voices, there is still a kind of homogenization of there is, it were, the questions that you're allowed to ask that get on the airwaves. We call it the news, but it's a very basic thing. It's not the news. It's some news masquerading as the news. And we need to keep that constantly in mind, because very important questions keep getting lost. And we saw that to devastating effect during the financial crisis, also over some of the foreign military adventures that the United States has been involved in. Information doesn't always get through to the numbers of people that it needs to get to.
I mean, you're a sometime philosopher. Maybe that's the angle you're bringing to this. There are so many analyses of the different streams of news now, what works and what doesn't. You want more context. Maybe you want more context than the news will ever deliver. I mean, you know, do you want news that would satisfy Plato and Sophocles?
Yeah. Well, I'm asking, in a way, what should the news ideally be? So let me take an example, a typical thing that I do in the book. I look at the unbelievable appetite that people have for murder stories. This distresses serious journalists who think, you know, murder isn't something that should be, you know, discussed so much by serious people. It's a grim and
rubbernecking
kind of thing.
It happens, but yeah.
It happens, exactly. Now, I look at that and I think, you know, as a philosopher, I think, okay, actually, if you look at the most poignant, important bits of art that our civilizations have produced, they tend to hinge around murder. In other words, there is nothing low, trivial around murder.
The head of John the Baptist or whatever it might be.
Right. When it gets squashed into a news report, it's very easy to think, well, this is just trivial. So my target in the book is not just, as it were, you know, serious news is not serious enough. It's also that certain bits of news that are commonly considered low are not treated with the complexity that they should be. Take car crashes. You know, car crashes, perennial fascination, air crashes. People love a good air crash. Are we sick? No, we're not sick. We're looking for the meaning of life. Very often what we're doing with these stories of sudden disaster is getting in touch with something that we forget day to day, which is our incredible vulnerability to natural and mechanical accident. And these stories grip us because they remind us of the fragility of life. So there's something very important going on, but too often we think, oh, you know, that's just, you know, grim popular news. It's not. There's very subtle things going on. So, as I say, I'm not just targeting, you know, the so-called serious stuff. I'm looking across the board of high and low news.
I wonder if the news has to analyze it all in every moment, if there isn't just sometimes news. Here, this is just facts. These are things that have happened. I mean, do you have to send Aristotle or Seneca alongside the reporter to give you that?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Absolutely not. But, you know, facts on their own can only help you so much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the news, the flow, the torrent of news, what it is, what it should be, with Alain de Botton. His new book is The News, A User's Manual. Here's just a stream of headlines, ABC, NBC, CBS, just this week.
Welcome to World News Tonight. Most wanted, the news pouring in about the billionaire drug lord who targeted American cities, digging underground tunnels, using a submarine, even this catapult to toss bales of drugs over the border.
On our broadcast tonight, battle lines in Arizona over a controversial plan that some say would legalize discrimination. Tonight, high drama over the governor's decision.
After seeing his palace, Ukrainians want the head of the president they overthrew. Holly Williams got into the mansion today.
Historic cuts at the Pentagon, the new battle plan to shrink the military to something not seen since before World War II.
In a given night, there's the flavor of American news. Alain de Botton joins us from London. He wrote How Proust Can Change Your Life, How to Think More About Sex, The Art of Travel, The Architecture of Happiness, and many more. His new book is The News, A User's Manual. In a few minutes, we'll hear from the news director at BuzzFeed, Lisa Tozzi, formerly at the New York Times. Okay, Alain, you just heard that flow of American news headlines from this week. Is that so bad?
Yeah. Well, I love it because, you know, what sticks out is the unbelievable seriousness, the sonorousness. It's the music. It's the voice basically saying, you know, shove everything else out of the way. We are the most important thing in your life. These are the headlines. This is the truth.
Well, what do you want? It's the news. It's just what happened.
No, well, it's so self-important. It takes itself as the arbiter. You know, I say in the book that it is, in a way, the replacement of religion. It stands over our lives and says, this is the world, this is reality. It isn't. It is a very selective vision. I mean, you know,
is this just cultural? You want a nice dry wine, a nice dry BBC delivery instead? No.
I mean, we have exactly the same. This is, you know, it came from us to you. That sonorous, you know, we used to have Big Ben chiming and you guys took it. So it's all over the world. The news is the pulpit, and it says these are the important things. You know, listen up, people. This is what we've discovered about the truth of reality.
Well, don't you want the news to cut through some of the clutter of the day and say, hey?
Of course, but it's very important that it genuinely is the truth, and by its very nature, it cannot be. We talked about the financial crisis. Was there a sonorous voice going, Americans, your banks are kidding you? You know, you've got a totally corrupt financial system. Was it saying that? No, it wasn't. It was saying, you know, man in Arizona arrested for, you know, sunbathing or taking drugs.
Wait a minute.
Whatever it was. In other words, it wasn't the real story.
The Prime Minister of Ukraine is chased out of office. That's not a man sunbathing in Arizona.
No, but during your most serious financial crisis, your news was not aware of what was going on. So I'm merely taking that example as a sign that we have to keep our wits about us, that, as it were, the news pretends to have sifted the entire basis of reality and have come down to the most important questions. If we start to adopt that point of view, we will very quickly fall prey to ideologies and mass delusions that are waiting for us. And the media does this again and again, despite the proliferation of many, many news outlets.
Lots of questions there, but what would you... What would you have instead? I mean, with all that proliferation,
you've got to be skeptical.
Skepticism, sure, but you do have to prioritize. They have the evening news on television, let's say, has 30 minutes for that news, and after the ads, it's a lot less than that. They, by definition, then have to prioritize. Well, they can't just drone every detail out there and have you figure out
Tom,
what
you know,
might matter more.
One of the most amazing things about news, anyone who's worked in news knows about this, why are the headlines across so many organizations, CBS, NBC, etc., why are they always the same headlines? Who has decided that those are the important stories? There's a kind of unconscious guidance towards certain things, and those are prejudices, and huge numbers of other stories get missed out along the way. And that's part of the reason for that is that people in news are always looking at what other people in news are saying, rather than going out there and just looking at reality. They're constantly checking their neighbors, which is why you get these mass delusions. And that's just something to be aware of as consumers of the news. You know, I'm not saying that the news never delivers important information. Of course it does. It does some wonderful things. There's some terrific reporting out there. It's just as consumers, we have to keep our wits about us.
Funny you put it that way, because one of the things you're championing in this book and beyond, Alain, is what you call bias. You say we need bias, that facts alone end up just a welter that's confusing and boring and distracting. Now, most Americans will bristle, most anyway, will bristle at this idea of bringing bias into the news. Why are you championing that?
Well, very nice NPR Americans will bristle because there's an assumption that there's a hierarchy of news. At the bottom of the hierarchy, you get biased news. And people think Fox News, bad news. You know, people trying to sell me something. And then at the top of the hierarchy, you get, you know, unbiased news. So, you know, information that is unbiased.
I mean, Fox News viewers would surely not put it that way. Fox itself says fair and balanced, and its viewers tend to think
right.
Getting there and not elsewhere.
I'm giving the NPR line, which is, bad news is biased news. My argument is that actually bias is simply a way of evaluating and finding a way of saying what is important, what matters, what is valuable, what isn't. And that is a very useful thing that the news does. So, you know, you mentioned Britain and the British media system. You know, at the top of the tree, we've got the BBC, and the BBC is unbiased, really. It creates a problem because they can't ever decide on anything. So they'll say, you know, they'll have a piece on genital mutilation, and they'll say, you know, they'll have somebody who's against genital mutilation, but for balance, they'll have somebody who's pro-genital mutilation, just so that, you know, all sides have had a chance to pro-genocide.
I hear a fair bit of BBC. I don't think I've ever heard a pro-genital mutilation speaker, but maybe I just missed that broadcast.
The only point on which they definitively came down off their fence was over apartheid. After much soul-searching, they decided that apartheid was bad. Ever since then, they've tried to avoid taking any particular point of view. And that's, as it were, the educated elite view of good news. Good news is not biased. Now, my view is that that's a very patronizing view because most of the audience can spot bias a mile away. And therefore, it's much better to, as it were, it's much easier to know what you think when you're bouncing off somebody else who's telling you what they think. The really troubling thing is when someone's saying, look, I'm not thinking anything, I'm just giving you facts. A, that's probably not possible because everything is always has some kind of color.
Yep.
And so this kind of high-minded view that it's uncolored can oddly be trickier to get your mind around.
Isn't that in itself elitist, kind of patronizing? People can't figure out what they think about the facts. So just go ahead and pre-digest it and give them a biased or a values-laden, not that anything can be devoid of that, but to set out with that as a mission. I mean, you say, you know, deliver the news with perspective. You might give it a perspective like, here's a Walt Whitman perspective you write on the news, or Jane Austen, or Charles Dickens,
or
the Buddha. I mean, you're going to prepackage this is Buddhist news?
No, well, you know, it's interesting because when people think of bias, they think, you know, right wing, left wing. And my view is, hang on, guys, there's so many other kinds of biases that you could put on the news. In other words, a bias is simply a method of interpretation. Imagine Buddhist news, right? In other words, news that looks at things that are happening in the world through the lens of this philosophy of life, which we know as Buddhism. All sorts of things would emerge if you looked at news through a psychoanalytic lens or a lens of, you know, Walt Whitman or a lens of a neuroscientist. These are lenses that can be put across what you're seeing and different things emerge. And my view is these lenses can be very valuable, and we need to move beyond the idea that the only lenses available are rabid right-wingism or rabid left-wingism. There are many, many more perspectives, and we need to hear them.
Alain de Botton joins us from London. His new book is The News, A User's Manual. He says we need in the news more work of coordination and distillation and curation. We'll hear in just a moment from Lisa Tozzi of BuzzFeed. A couple of callers first. Lots lined up here. New Orleans, Jim is calling. Jim, you're on the air. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you for taking the call, Tom. I hope I can make this somewhat understandable. It would seem to me that it is terribly important that our young people be thoroughly taught about the use of the media, the use of the written word, all of Orwell's lessons, that they be taught about the ability to manipulate us by either, as you say, the selection of the news, which is a very, very tiny subset, or the slanting of the news. It's almost as though they might have to be taught that it is in the nature of those who could buy the media to send messages that are in their best interest. And somehow we have to ask our young people to look beyond what is given through the mass media to understand what might truly be important to them.
Jim, you're a smart listener. Let me ask you then, does that leave you wanting more fact-based news, stripped of value, which may turn out to be ideology or bias? Or does it take you to Alain's position that you'd rather have people just put their values right out front and give some bias along with the news and make it clear?
Well, I think that I would like to see more news on what is going on in our legislatures, so that we know who's doing what and exactly what the impact is. There's far too much hidden in that process.
You'll take just more inquiry, period. I mean, these days, thank you very much, Jim. Alain, these days...
I think Jim is so right.
Yes,
I mean,
in what dimension?
You know, his emphasis on education, that, you know, young people emerge, grow up into a world where the news is seen as natural. And whenever something is seen as natural, alarm bells ring, because this thing is not natural, it's manufactured. And we need to understand how it's manufactured and the biases that will intrude, not in a helpful way. So we just need to be aware that it is a man-made set of stories about reality. It is not reality in itself.
But that's kind of an old chestnut, isn't it? I mean, everybody knows you can't put everything out there. People are choosing, and yes, somebody owns the press, though these days, everybody nearly has some kind of access to distribution. You're saying you want the news to be not just the capacity to collect the facts, but a skill honed by intelligent bias at teasing out their relevance. And I get that. I think a lot of news organizations would say that's what they're attempting to do today.
Look, I think ultimately one of the things that news organizations don't ask themselves enough is what is the ultimate purpose of our news gathering? And if really pressed, they'll tend to say our goal is to hold power to account. This is a classic answer of what a journalist is trying to do.
Sure.
That's not good enough. Of course, it's important to hold power to account. But what's the point of holding power to account? So as a philosopher, I'm thinking that's not the ultimate end. It can't be the ultimate end because there must be something else. I think that the ultimate end of news is that it should be information that is given to the individual and the nation so that it can flourish, so that it can do well. That may sometimes involve holding the powerful to account, and it may involve a whole host of other things. But as it were, you need some sense of what this exercise is for. And I think too often, news organizations have no particularly clear sense of why they're picking the stories they're picking or what it is that they're ultimately aiming for, because they're slightly resting on a sloppy understanding that they're simply after the big story without asking themselves, what is a big story? What is a big story for? And I think there's too little thought. I sympathize with journalists. They're busy people. They've got a lot to do, but there's sometimes a little bit too much running around for the big story and a little bit too a little questioning about what one's actually looking for, and that's why so much gets missed.
Boy, I don't know. You may be right, but you're hanging out in different newsrooms than I hang out in. Those conversations and searching for the real weight, where's the real importance, is something I hear a lot of. Alain, please stand by in London. Lisa Tozzi is good enough to join us right now. She is former deputy editor of the New York Times National Desk. She's now news director at BuzzFeed. She joins us from New York. Lisa, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So what do you think of this critique, that there's a lot of running around and dumping out sort of unassociated facts and not taking responsibility for putting all the news in perspective, Lisa. It's a big mess.
I think every, you know, generation or so starts to wring their hands about how messy the news is. That's not a particularly new concern, but I do think that, in our newsroom and in newsrooms that I've worked in, because there is so much information, you know, with social media, with, you know, the internet, with 24-hour cable stations, that most of the journalists I know, put a big premium on providing context and clarity to all the information that's coming at people. I work with a lot of breaking news stories, and our, we feel our role during a breaking news story, because we are assuming that our readers are seeing a lot of the same stuff we are, is to make sure that we are being clear about what we know and what we don't know, about verifying things, about debunking things that aren't true. I think that is the role that a lot of people find themselves in, especially these days.
You know, you may be right about your operation, but Alan looks across the whole boardwalk and sees societies left confused and bored and distracted, because cumulatively that's not where things end up. Do you share that concern, Lisa?
I give people a lot more credit. I think people are engaged. You know, I spend a lot of time on social media, and I see people, when a big story happens, responding to that story by sharing the story with their, with their friends, when there's a disaster, trying to figure out what they can do to help the people involved. I don't necessarily think that it's, the news that's making people depressed, if that's what's going on.
Alan, give people a little more credit. They can sort through this. They're not as jostled and lost as you might think.
Of course, many people are, and, all's fine and well. But I think that there is an area. Lisa worked at the New York Times. The New York Times strapline, all the news that's fit to print, that is about the most dangerous strapline you could ever give a population. Because what it's saying is, we've done all the work for you, you lie back, and you take it from us.
Is that what you read in the pages of the New York Times? Is that really?
And my feeling is that no news source can ever do that role. It's only ever going to be a selection. I mean, of course it's not all the news that's fit to print. There's lots of other news that could have been fit
to print. Well, but of course, and everybody knows that. I mean,
they don't, because that's why societies miss major insights.
Well, it's not that they don't miss major insights, of course.
Well, why in that case did the Western world more or less fall off the cliff unheralded, because people had not realized an enormously important tranche of news about the financial workings of their system? I mean, this only happened 3-4 years ago. So we are, within very short-term memory.
And 9/11 before that, and on and on.
Hey, Lisa, news organization.
Lisa, you were there at the Times for those. Did you just screw up, Lisa?
No, I don't think we screwed up. I think people were working on these stories and trying to get to these stories, and there were, bits and pieces of some of the stuff reported. Did it capture the public's attention, and did it give the whole story? Maybe not, but I don't think it was a screw-up. I know people were working hard to get to the bottom of these things.
And yet there's a real feeling that maybe we're missing something in the news these days. Lisa Tozzi, now news director at BuzzFeed. Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the news, the flow, the torrent of news. What it is, what it should be, could be, with Alain Dabotton. He joins us from London. He's author of the new book, The News, A User's Manual. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. You know, Alain, it's funny. I've been in the news business for a long time. At one point, I left it in the 90s. You described earlier how we imagine the news being important because we inform, and that informing motivates, and the world changes in a good way. And I don't know, one day was in Somalia, Mogadishu, with a rocket-propelled grenade launcher up against the side of my head, and just thought, this is just going in circles. It's not going anywhere. I'm out. And then 9/11 came, and for many Americans, for me certainly, it was a reminder the news really matters. You've got to have it, both the facts and the context and the understanding, and you can't quit.
But that's very interesting, very, very moving, I think, because you're absolutely right. And, you know, I wonder whether your earlier crisis was connected up with a sense that maybe you were, there were clearly important stories out there, but were you able to get them? Was the bureau chief responsive? Was the net that you'd been given the right one with which to catch the things that really mattered? And, you know, lots has been said about how 9/11 was an intelligence failure. I think there's that in the narrow sense, and then there's in the broader sense. The narrow sense is, you know, they missed a particular trace of information, etc. But I think the broader sense is more interesting, which is, did Americans have a proper awareness of the depths of, you know, feeling, the anger, the madness directed against it in some parts of the world, and you know, perhaps that didn't get through. So look, no news organization will ever be perfect. So the question is, as a consumer of news, what do you do? And I think the most important thing to do is to remember that you don't know. I mean, there's a basic kind of philosophical insight there, but you know, a realization of ignorance, a skepticism about what you know, seems so essential, particularly when it comes to this thing we call world news, which is perhaps more than any other kind of news, compromised by a range of factors.
Yeah, I mean, I get that, and yet we need to push beyond that. You know, we've known for a long time that it's important to understand what you don't know, and yet the news is supposed to deliver that and light it up. Linda in Milwaukee. Linda, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I was calling to help your guest a little bit. I was a local news person, worked in television news in various markets, and I agree with him totally. I mean, I left news because I was fundamentally frustrated with how it is done and produced. I can't tell you how many conversations I've been in meetings where people say that's boring. Anything that is of any level of interest is boring. Now, it's one thing to talk about the rarefied world of the New York Times, which, quite frankly, the majority of Americans don't read, and the local news, where very basic information is being sloppily put together, quickly put together, without any context and without any desire to have any context. And when you add to that, you have a problem of people who don't know their subject matter. And then this issue of frightening people. We convince people that their community is scary, that they're going to be raped or murdered, that their neighbors are scary. And to me, that seemed to be our primary role. And I agree with him. I mean, we would get stories from the Associated Press that were wrong, that were incorrect, that did not have proper context, and no one, because people frequently didn't have subject matter background, couldn't suss out what was wrong.
So, Linda, you were in the biz. How do you interpret this? I mean, why would the news business just be out to push people's buttons? Because they're lazy? Because it's cheaper to do that? Because they're afraid to go outside?
What? It's cheaper. People, again, don't have subject matter expertise. I mean, I did come into news with a background, a legal background, actually, a different background.
Yeah.
I do think that there needs to be higher standards with people who come in with some subject matter expertise, and I think it's cheaper. And also, no one wants to be controversial now. This is another really big thing. When healthcare reform came in, no one wanted to take any time to approach the matter properly because they get lots of calls from conservatives or lots of calls from liberals. So let's just make it confusing straight down the middle
just
for everyone.
Keep your head down, make it confusing, and hope you can survive. And now you're out. Linda, I appreciate your call. We have so many lined up here. Let me get a couple more. Jim in Newtown, Connecticut. Jim, you're on.
Thank you, Tom. I would like to ask your guest if you could speak to what happened last July when David Gregory was speaking with Glenn Greenwald about Snowden, and Gregory effectively, he asked a loaded question saying, quote, to the extent that you, Glenn Greenwald, have aided and abetted Snowden, even in his current movements, why shouldn't you be charged with the crime? And there was a lot of pushback against that, but that there's that point. And then following that in January, we have the Director of National Intelligence, James R. Clapper, saying further that all reporters who might publishes information are accomplices to Snowden. I'll take my answer.
Articulate your concern in that, though, Jim. Did you think that Gregory was what? Challenging Greenwald for helping get information out? Is that your concern?
I think that it is emblematic of figures within the media who are so close to the government that they want to present as news an outright outrageous attack on he's questioning another journalist in a way that I think is just emblematic of too close a relationship to power.
Another journalist who brought a lot of big information, news, to light, you'd have to say, whatever you think of it. Alan, what about these two? Linda in Milwaukee has said, yes, you know, she's worked in local TV news and A to Z, it's pretty much as you say. And then our caller in Newtown, Connecticut, no small address, worried about the challenge to people who have dug in from others who may be too close to the power structure.
You know, I think Linda's most persuasive point for me was about this business of the news scaring people. There is that thing that, you know, if you break down in your car on a cold, wet night, you know, you suspect that when you go and ask a stranger for help, you will become a victim of crime, you will be killed, chopped in small pieces, become a victim of paedophilia, weirdness,
and yet people help each other out every day all over the place.
Exactly. And that never comes through. It's a very basic point. The news is the anomaly. That's why it makes the news. But because we spend all our time looking at the news, our vision of the country that we live in becomes assembled out of one anomalous story after another. In other words, we have a fundamental distortion in our view of our fellow Americans. And that starts to become a political problem because the view of what country we live in has been shaped by a sequence of deeply unusual events. And so we miss the steady state of a place. So that's what I would say to Linda. As for the other point...
And yeah, look, don't you want to know if there's a murder in your town or certainly on your block? I mean, you do want the heads up. We have had crime problems.
Absolutely. But I think what we very quickly start to lose out on is statistics. How normal is this? You know, this happens when celebrity news is reported. How statistically normal is it to look beautiful and perfect? You know, if you talk to adolescent girls, they are tormented by ideals of beauty that have been paraded in front of them by the media that are statistically about as rare as a double murder.
And, I'm reading you from your book here. You say celebrity news should. I mean, you've got it on your own website. We'll talk about that. But should, in its mature form, be a serious and respectable medium through which we can learn to become more than we currently are? Yeah, I mean, it seems like you're saying there's a place for it.
Look, I think every society needs role models. And part of the problem of so-called serious news is that the serious news is not interested in the business of celebrity and role models. That is abandoned to the so-called low news. So the lowest common denominator outlets decide who is famous, which is why you get the celebrities that you have. And then people get very upset and say, oh, you know, what's wrong with the modern world is this thing called celebrity culture. Well, look, all societies have to have role models. And so, you know, the task is to work our way through to the role models that best reflect the kind of society we want to live in. And the whole cheapening of the term celebrity and the association of celebrities with people actually who do not deserve their fame is one of the more paradoxical and harmful features of our age. You know, in religious ages, you had saints and the saints were held up as exemplars. In ancient Greece, you had role models, you know, you had heroes, athletes, etc. And these were people who were doing a very important job for the whole of society. We're a little bit muddled in the whole business of what a celebrity could and should be.
Who's going to be the arbiter of these great values? I mean, you have your own website now called The Philosopher's Mail. It's laid out like a regular news site. It has a lot of news on it. But, you know, I don't know. Paris Hilton reads Epicurus, you know, interview with the soul of David Beckham. You've got Selena on here and Paris Hilton and Gwyneth Paltrow. And I mean, you're writing about pretty standard celebrities
Let me explain. So while I was writing this book, I got together with some philosopher friends. And one of them said to me, you know, the average work of philosophy nowadays gets 300 readers only. And then I remembered reading a little while before that the world's most popular English language news website is this site called The Mail Online, the Daily Mail of the UK. Mm-hmm. It receives 40 million hits a day. So you've got 300 people reading a philosophy book and 40 million reading the average, great news site. Now, what is going on there? What is that, you know, that scale, that disparity? Anyway, it was a kind of late night thought experiment. I thought, okay, what happens if you set a bunch of philosophers to rewrite the Daily Mail, to rewrite the Mail Online, keeping all the same stories, but rewriting them with an attention to the kinds of things that philosophers care about, complexity, justice, you know, truth, etc. But you stay with those stories. You don't go down the road of The Guardian or The New York Times, in other words, and say, that's a low story, I'm not getting involved. You stay with all the same stories, but you see where you can take your audience. This is an experiment we've been running. We've had a huge success, and it's, you know, it's been fun to do. It's a provocative way of saying, how could this kind of tension between the high and the low be explored and something taken from it?
It is funny to see it laid out in the juxtaposition or opposition here. You've got pedophile rapist Stuart Hall's wife leaves him after fresh rape charges. Now let's try to get into his mind. Okay.
That was, that was because, of course, you know, one of the things the news does is to prevent sympathy, not even sympathy. Let me put it differently. It prevents the humanization of the criminal, because most news organizations are terrified that if we get to humanize the criminal, we'll want to open the jail doors and the world will be awash with crazy people. And it doesn't allow the audience the complexity of thinking, okay, on the one hand, of course, this person belongs in prison for a long time, possibly forever, and they can't be forgiven. But the audience can move towards understanding, and that seems to be a trick that is almost congenitally missing from the reporting of serious crime stories.
If philosophers ran the newsroom, here's another headline from the Philosopher's Mail: Man too optimistic about relationships jumps out of a hotel window after argument with his wife. David in Des Moines, Iowa. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tom. I'm a recovering journalist, too, and I don't think any of us that have ever been in a newsroom have missed the phrase, if it bleeds, it leads. And I remember when I had a come-to-Jesus meeting similar to yours when I was down in Nicaragua, and I was covering a lot of the revolution, a lot of the dirty war that the United States was perpetrating on basically farmers and children and killing them in our name with our money. And I became completely frustrated. I would file story after story after story, knowing full well that nothing, and this was mostly for the AP, that none of it would be covered. And it came out in alternative news sources. It didn't have the import that the alternative news sources didn't have the import, and therefore it never got into the public consciousness.
And David, do you think we're still making that kind of mistake today?
Absolutely. I mean, I hear you, and I heard the person from the New York Times saying we didn't get it wrong. But if the New York Times can't handle Wall Street, then who can?
That's a very good question. It's in their backyard. Recovering journalist there in Des Moines. One more here. Ed in Pleasant Plains, Illinois. Ed, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I basically just have one comment. Follow the money. There's five huge organizations that are owned by corporations. This is where our news, so-called news, originates. Okay? That's it. It's real simple.
Follow the money. What, you think that all they care about is a profit? Of course, I'm sure they do want that. Thank you, Ed. Yet not every news service is a for-profit news service. Your BBC, Alan, included. Our NPR included.
Maybe it sets the table,
even so.
You know, I'm more pessimistic. I think if you could just follow the money and work out all the distortions and quirks of news because of finance, I think in a way it would be easy, because there's a logic to money. I think it's even weirder and in a way more sinister than that, which is that there are filters in, you know, people's minds that mean that certain questions, things that are going on in Nicaragua or elsewhere, don't appear as part of the legitimate agenda. Mm-hmm. And it's not just financial. You know, the Chomsky line is, it's all financial. It's all a conspiracy for money. It's not just that. I think some of these things are plain old, stupidity, if you like, narrow-mindedness. It's not just that people are greedy, though they are that as well.
There's the line that journalists and others sometimes use, saying that people, societies, get the news, the journalism they deserve, that they'll get served up whatever they require. If there's some truth in that, what are you telling people to ask for, to require?
Look, I'm more optimistic than that. I mean, if, you know, apply that argument to other things like, you know, nation gets the education it requires or the food it requires. That's not true. You know, we all deserve a very high standard of food, education, and of course, news. There's no reason why any nation should accept a bad standard of news. I'm hugely ambitious. I think we're still at the dawn of news. You know, sometimes it can feel like we've got everything, we know everything, we understand it all. No, we're still, this is a young country, it's a young democracy. We're still working out how to find our way to the news that we need to be functioning human beings and a functioning state and nation. And I don't think we've cracked it yet. I think it's getting better, but I think it's still very, very early days. And what I was trying to do in my book is just complicate our sense to continue that process that, of course, others have been involved in for years, which is to just keep asking that question, which I think we can't ever let rest, which is, what is this thing we're doing, taking in the news, and how can we make sure we get the news that we really need, not just so-called deserve, but really need?
Well, it's clear that there's lots of room to improve. I came back to it because it just became so clear that we do really need it, and we've got to have it just as good and strong and clear as we can make it. A lot of work to do on that front. Alain de Botton, you help us think that through, and we're grateful for it. The new book is The News, A User's Manual. Alain, in London, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for being with us. As always, On Point is produced by Emily Alphen-Johnson, Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gale-Rosen, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Catherine Hart, Claire Lancaster, and Sarah Platt. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.